What were we discussing? We were saying that the Islamic Republic can play a role in the transition period. Yes. In what areas? One, in the field of official interaction with other governments in the framework of multilateralism. Our 25-year cooperation plan with the Chinese government is one of its approaches, with the Russian government in the framework of a 20-year long-term cooperation plan. One of its manifestations is the discussion of the New World Order. With India, we're following the same long-term strategic approach. With other powers in the Americas, with Venezuela, we will finalize this 20-year long-term framework. We have the same plan with Brazil, especially in the new era, when a new government has come to power in this country. This is the governmental domain. In the intellectual domain of the Islamic Revolution, the extension of the Islamic Revolution in our own region, which is the resistance front, I mean, as an element of undeniable power, not just the issue of resistance, but as a model of governance. Because you see, some people want to falsely introduce resistance as only a preventive model, an effective force that can stand against occupation, aggression, and domination, who has succeeded in this and it keeps withstanding. It expelled Israel from Lebanon. In Palestine, it was able to grow as a serious power element against the continuation of Zionist hegemony, and a main obstacle to the continuation of the Zionist regime's hegemony is this current of internal resistance in Palestine. In Iraq and Syria, it showed in practice that it can preserve territorial integrity and consolidate national sovereignty. It can also destroy the terrorist movement supported by foreigners, because now it is true that we have terrorist groupings both in Iraq and Syria, but the appearance that they wanted was to present themselves as a sovereign. And practically, this resistance current showed that no, it will not allow them to continue their plan. So this is their preventive dimension. In addition to this preventive aspect, resistance current has a creative aspect. That is, it does not just prevent, but it can also create. In Lebanon, Hezbollah plays a fundamental role in governance and in establishing order, in providing people's well-being and comfort. The whole world is witness. In the same way, in Syria and Iraq, these currents in various fields, whether in the form of parties or other popular currents, were able to show their creative aspects with their presence in the government and the consolidation and cohesion in the government. So this is an element of strength that can be developed and will not be limited to our region. They want to weaken this in our region so this current does not permeate into other communities, so that if people in other regions follow suit, they would think it would be too costly. This is the plan of Westerners and foreigners for the resistance movement. Allow me to sum up my remarks here by saying that the Islamic Republic of Iran has both a vision and a long-term plan for the new international order, and has adopted measures to be able to present a new approach with the cooperation of other powers in the form of multilateralism in the international scene, an approach that guarantees the establishment of order with a justice-oriented perspective and horizon in the world.
برقراری نظم با چشمانداز و افق عدالت محور باشه.
Well, that's very interesting, Doctor, because it seems to me that you mentioned things like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, BRICS Plus, you know, things that are now happening in the world that are manifestations of this new order, which you described very, very nicely and with detail. But I want to stay a little bit with the idea that Iran itself has changed also in this period. That Iran, the Iran that we have today, is not the Iran of 20, 30 years ago. So when we had the revolution, we saw that this, in a way, what you were mentioning is that a lot of these countries are not new powers. They are old powers that are retaking their position that they had historically in terms of human civilization, particularly those countries that are in Asia. But I want to stick with Iran because, yes, of course, China has always been a large country, a big powerful country in terms of human history. We have Russia as the in a way, inheritor of the Soviet Union and that history which is close to us. But if we look at Iran, both in terms of hard power and real power, but and also the soft power and the ideological power, Iran, if it takes its natural position, is a powerful country in the world on the same level as many other countries. Some might say, okay, it doesn't have the population of China, it doesn't have the size of Russia, but we see in history that a lot of countries, Britain, Holland, Portugal, that might be smaller, much smaller than Iran is now, and much less powerful in terms of population and hard power, were able to, you know, have a very significant effect on global affairs. So I want to stick with this idea that Iran is also one of these countries, because you talked about the changes that are happening being related to real changes of power, that there's a real decline of U.S. power and there's a real increase of power of other countries. So if you could please, let's delve a little deeper, because people might say that we're just trying to do, you know, we're just saying something, but it's based on reality. What, in your opinion, in your analysis, are the real factors of the hard, real power that Iran has, and of course the soft power that you were talking about? Because we talked about the idea that Iran doesn't go to Venezuela and say to, for example, Venezuela that, you know, you have to be Iranian, be Iranian. America does that. It goes to countries and says, become American. So Iran talks about this, and the Supreme Leader has talked about this many times, that it's the same thing that Imam Ali talked about, which is we don't oppress and we don't accept oppression, this idea which is an Islamic concept. And this seems to me is the most revolutionary thing you can say in the world, in a world that's based on an oppressor and people accepting oppression. Here's Iran saying, be yourself, don't accept oppression and don't oppress.
به نکته به نظرم مهمی حضرت عالی اشاره کردید. نیا کنید.
You raised an important point. Look, from both hard and soft elements of power, Iran, the Islamic Revolution, and the Islamic Republic have characteristics that, in my opinion, are in objective states. That is, they can be touched and observed. In the field of hard power, the elements of Iran's power are abundant, from its location and land area in the world, to its resources, to its human resources, to many other areas. On the other hand, it is an aspect of soft power that is aimed at the people of Iran and their beliefs, which originated from the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic. The important point, in my opinion, is that the soft power of the Islamic Revolution for other nations is not that they become Iranian, but that they be true to themselves. I remember a while ago, a European journalist asked me, "What do you want from us Europeans? What do you expect of us to be satisfied, for example?" I told him that we don't expect anything more from you, that you should only look after your own interests. If Europe pursues its own interests, we would have no problem with Europe, and Europe would have no problem with us. The problem is where you pursue the interests of other parties and create problems for yourselves and others. We have a religious belief that, for example, it is also mentioned in the Quran, that, for example, don't be afraid of poverty because of having offspring. When you have a child, the one who gives the child, who is God, also provides its sustenance. It is the same in the national format. When God Almighty gives identity to a nation, He also gives them power. But sometimes, or many times, the nations do not realize the elements of their power due to various reasons, including weakness, being weakened by the dominating powers. In my opinion, one of Imam Khomeini's miracles in the Islamic Revolution was the identification and recognition of the elements of the power of the Iranian nation. And more important than that was the transformation of the elements of power into real authority. And this placed us in very difficult circumstances at the beginning of the war imposed by Saddam against the Iranian people, where we even needed to import the most obvious defense tools, such as barbed wire from abroad, They didn't give it to us because we were banned. We were forced into the war in this environment, and we finished a war with ballistic missile capability while we were under sanctions. How is this possible? What kind of soft power is this that without receiving help from outside, even though you were sanctioned, you not only resisted and protected yourself, but you could transcend? Well, this soft power is strong. This soft power was given to other nations after the war, and you can see the result in Palestine. You can see it in Lebanon. You can see it in Syria. You can see it in Iraq. You can see it in Yemen. For example, in Syria and Iraq, there were two governments with two armies against the terrorists. But the governments and the armies of those two countries themselves admit that what defeated the terrorists was the popular resistance movement, which is the soft power of the Islamic Revolution that can empower the people, the masses. The interesting thing is that the people's movement that is formed in Iraq seeks to secure Iraq's national interests in Syria. It seeks national interests in Syria. In Lebanon, it seeks national interests in Lebanon. The resistance, which is a single identity, does not have this conflict at all. And this is the virtuosity of the Islamic Revolution. That is, this is the inclusiveness of the Islamic Revolution, which is a global revolution. As you rightly pointed out, so did the U.S. and the Soviet Union. When it wanted to develop, when it went to Europe, it implemented its own system. That's why when the foundations of governance in Moscow became weak, all of them collapsed at once, because they were artificial, imposed, not belonging to those countries, they were not people-based, but the thinking of the Islamic Revolution is not like that. Therefore, what I want to say is that the correct point that you mentioned, that the Islamic Republic of Iran has power elements that can play an effective, strategic, and influential role in the new order, with these power elements in the new order, including in the framework of multilateralism, is a fact. This is not just a claim. During the war in Syria, the actor who created the space for Russia to act there was the Islamic Republic. That is, this comprehensiveness of soft power imbues the model of the Islamic Republic, which can streamline a popular movement alongside the world power and the national government of that country towards a goal, which is national independence, maintaining territorial integrity, providing national interests, and providing the welfare and comfort of the people of that country. You rarely see a framework and mechanism in the world that can create such synergy. So this is the comprehensiveness of the view, model, and soft power of the Islamic Revolution, which can help shape a new and stable order in the form of multilateralism.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Nikki Haley, a former United Nations ambassador and governor of South Carolina, is planning to announce a presidential run. we take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Washington Post has covered this story and tells us more. Nikki Haley, a former United Nations ambassador and governor of South Carolina, is planning to announce that she will run for president, positioning herself to be the first declared Republican challenger to Donald Trump, at a time when other prospective candidates have slowed their moves. Nikki Haley could release a video signaling her decision as soon as this week, a strategy as described by multiple people briefed on the plans who spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to talk publicly, intended to drive attendance and enthusiasm for an in-person announcement event in the coming weeks. Haley plans to officially announce her run in Charleston, South Carolina on 15th of February, according to one person briefed on the plans. A date first reported by the Post and Courier newspaper in Charleston, South Carolina. Some political advisers have been relocating to the Charleston area for the campaign. Nikki Haley's decision to lean into the race bucks the more cautious strategy adopted by most other potential candidates, who have decided there is no need to rush their preparations. Advisers to these Republicans, many of whom spoke on condition of anonymity, described private conversations, said there is a wariness about becoming an early target of former President Donald Trump. Some of the advisers also voiced hope that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who has made preliminary moves towards a run, faces early scrutiny because of his high national polling, scrutiny that could work to their advantage. They added that there is a general sense in their circles that there is enough time to learn more about how the race will play out and still attract donors, get on ballots and build campaign infrastructure. There's no benefit to being in early, said David Urban, a former Trump advisor who is friendly with multiple would-be 2024 candidates. Urban added, you don't want to be in the ring getting banged on by the former president in a one-on-one. There's no reason anyone has to get in right now. There's no urgency for anyone. Everyone is sitting and waiting. Much of the consequential action in the race so far has taken place in private conversations and strategy sessions rather than early state barnstorms, such as methodical preparation by aides to former Vice President Mike Pence and Ron DeSantis advisors behind-the-scenes moves to identify potential staff and plan travel. Even Donald Trump has moved slowly after his early announcement. The former president hit the trail this past week for the first time since launching his campaign in November, promising a campaign about the future and about issues, even as he returned to some old grievances, falsely telling Republicans in New Hampshire that he won two general elections, a reference to his claims of victory in 2020. Some Republican leaders have urged the party to move on and view the former president as politically weakened after disappointing midterm elections in which Donald Trump's endorsed candidates lost key races. One question that looms over the jockeying for position is where wealthy Republican donors will decide to put their money. Some major donors who were with Donald Trump in 2020 have not yet committed to his re-election, even after entreaties from Donald Trump advisers. As one advisor to a major GOP donor put it, I don't think anybody in our world has picked a horse yet. CBS News has also covered this story and tells us more. Nikki Haley, a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and South Carolina governor, is expected to officially announce her 2024 presidential run on 15th of February in Charleston, South Carolina, according to two South Carolina Republicans familiar with her plans. Nikki Haley would become the first Republican candidate to join former President Donald Trump in the Republican presidential primary. Haley's last hint at a 2024 run came earlier this month during a Fox News interview in which she called for generational change when looking at the future of the country. "I don't think you need to be 80 years old to be a leader in Washington, D.C., the 51-year-old Nikki Haley said. "I think we need a younger generation to come in, step up, and really start fixing things." "When you're looking at a run for president, you look at two things," Haley added. "You first look at, does the current situation push for new leadership? The second question is, am I that person and could be that, and could I be that new leader? So do I think I could be that leader? Yes. But we're still working through things and we'll figure it out. I've never lost a race. I said that then. I still say it now. I'm not going to lose now." In the 2022 midterm election cycle, though her Stand for America PAC, Nikki Haley campaigned for Republicans up and down the ticket and took trips to Iowa, to New Hampshire, and to Nevada, all early presidential primary states. She was also a close surrogate on the trail of Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin and Senate candidates Dr. Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania and Herschel Walker in Georgia. Nikki Haley has consistently polled third or fourth in early 2024 GOP primary surveys. In a Trafalgar Group poll in late January of South Carolina primary voters, Nikki Haley was placed fourth and got 11.6% of the vote in a field that included Donald Trump, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, South Carolina Governor Tim Scott, former Vice President Mike Pence, and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Tim Scott, another potential 2024 contender from the Palmetto State, is traveling to Iowa for the Polk County Republican Party's annual Lincoln Dinner in late February. Nikki Haley stepped from the governor's office to the international stage at the United Nations, rounding out credentials that would prepare her for a campaign like this. "It's like a countdown at NASA, T-minus 2 weeks and counting," said Dave Wilson, president of the Christian nonprofit Palmetto Family Council. Nikki Haley notched one symbolic win against Donald Trump last year in the primary for South Carolina's 1st congressional district, when Haley backed Representative Nancy Mace. Nancy Mace defeated Donald Trump's endorsed candidate, former Representative Katie Arrington, by about 9 percentage points. Trump told reporters traveling with him on Saturday to South Carolina for a campaign stop that Nikki Haley had reached out to her ex-boss to inform him that she was considering running for the White House. "She called me and said she'd like to consider it, and I said, 'You should do it,'" Trump recounted. "I talked to her for a little while. I said, 'Look, you know, go by your heart if you want to run.'" Nikki Haley, a South Carolina native who was the first female and Indian American governor in state history, told the Associated Press in April of 2021 that she would not challenge Donald Trump if he decided to run again. Trump nominated Haley for the United Nations ambassadorship after his win in 2016. "I would not run if President Trump ran, and I would talk to him about it," Nikki Haley said at the time. But since then, she has suggested repeatedly that she is seriously considering a run. The former South Carolina governor told Fox News Channel that her comments about not running against Donald Trump were made before some perceived flaws of President Joe Biden's administration, such as the withdrawal from Afghanistan and a dramatic rise in inflation.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is on the final leg of his trip to Latin America, where he has met with a number of high-ranking officials in an effort to boost bilateral and multilateral relations. Cuba was the latest destination of Amir Abdollahian, where he met with Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel. During the meeting, they discussed matters of mutual interest at bilateral and international levels. The top Iranian diplomat voiced his country's categorical support for Havana while condemning sanctions on Cuba and foreign intervention in its internal affairs. Díaz-Canel, for his part, said despite all the existing pressures, Cuba is determined to cooperate with friendly countries and work with them to eliminate obstacles and challenges lying ahead. The Cuban president criticized U.S. unilateralism and said that his country has earned political independence at a high price and would preserve it. Amir Abdollahian also met with his Cuban counterpart, Bruno Rodriguez Parrilla. Both diplomats wrapped the U.S. sanctions policy against others, including Iran and several South American countries, saying such a policy is doomed to fail. Before Cuba, the top Iranian diplomat paid a visit to Venezuela, which is maintaining strong bilateral relations with Tehran. During a meeting between Amir Abdollahian and Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the two sides discussed ways to strengthen cooperation further in various fields, including energy. They also called for heightened vigilance in the face of U.S.-led pressure and bullying. Maduro also pointed to common challenges being faced by Venezuela and Iran. Amir Abdollahian also traveled to Nicaragua as part of his Latin American trip. In a meeting with President Daniel Ortega, he condemned all lawful sanctions imposed by the U.S. and certain Western countries on Iranian individuals and entities. He stressed, however, that the Islamic Republic has managed to move forward despite the coercive measures designed to stop the country's progress. Amir Abdollahian voiced Tehran's eagerness for closer cooperation in various fields, saying Iran sets no limits to the promotion of cooperation with Nicaragua. Ortega, for his part, highlighted shared concerns of Tehran and Managua. He said that the two countries have a common enemy, adding that what Iran fought and defeated in 1979 was the same Nicaraguans rose up against in the same year. Amir Abdollahian's visit to Latin America puts under the spotlight the significance of his meeting with officials there. One of the most important points highlighted by almost all leaders was that the ongoing developments in Latin America and elsewhere in the world are creating new opportunities for multilateralism. That was particularly underlined by the top Iranian diplomat, who dismissed unilateralism as an obsolete doctrine on the global stage. He stressed that unilateralism cannot respond to developments and changes taking place worldwide. In the case of Iran and Venezuela, the officials of the two OPEC members found a common ground to solidify their relations to deal with a common enemy, the United States, which has come up with crippling sanctions against them for years. Standing against the U.S. and Western imperialism was another topic of discussion during the Iranian official's visit. That was underscored in Daniel Ortega's comments, where he said the enemies of global peace and tranquility have maintained their imperialistic policies and considered the whole world, not just Latin America, as their backyard. Ortega, however, expressed hope that imperialism cannot last any longer. On sanctions, Latin American leaders echoed the stance of the Iranian foreign minister, who called such measures terrorist threat being used by imperial powers as leverage. They stressed the need for boosting cooperation in trade and technology, among other things, to overcome those curbs. It seems that shared challenges have brought these countries together to push against U.S. hegemony. And what could make a difference? Moving away from the US dollar, establishing a common currency, enhancing bilateral and multilateral trade. It seems that an oriental shift is largely taking place in today's world. That is visible in countries on the African continent that are trying to enhance ties with the East, namely Russia and China, and Latin American nations that are standing firm against US unilateralism. All these point to their rejection of Western hegemony. The balloon's journey across the ocean has gripped the world's attention. On Friday, the U.S. military said it mobilized fighter jets, but advised President Joe Biden against shooting the balloon out of the sky for fear debris could pose a safety threat. U.S. authorities said the military took custody of the balloon when it entered America's airspace. On Saturday, however, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the balloon, which was being used by China in an attempt to surveil strategic sites in the continental United States, was brought down above U.S. territorial waters. Pentagon also snapped what it called China's unacceptable violation. China has expressed regret, blaming winds for pushing what it called a civilian airship into U.S. airspace. Beijing said the balloon was used for meteorological purposes and had unintentionally escaped into U.S. airspace. The incident prompted U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken to issue a personal note to his Chinese counterpart condemning Beijing's move.
China's decision to fly a surveillance balloon over the continental United States is both unacceptable and irresponsible. That's what this is about. It's a violation of our sovereignty. It's a violation of international law.
Blinken further added that the U.S. remains committed to diplomatic engagement with China and that he would make a trip to Beijing once conditions are favorable. Some White House allies say postponing Blinken's trip was an overreaction to the incident, particularly because U.S. officials have said that they do not think the balloon was able to gather information that cannot be acquired in other ways, such as spy satellites. In a phone call with his American counterpart, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said China and the United States should handle occasional individual cases in a calm and professional manner. Wang stressed that China has always strictly abided by international laws and will not accept any groundless conjecture or hype. In the face of unexpected situations, what both sides should do is to maintain steadiness, communicate in time, avoid misjudgment, and manage differences. Meanwhile, the Pentagon said it spotted a second similar balloon flying over Latin America. Beijing already denied the U.S. accusation of spying. It accused U.S. media and politicians of using the recent balloon incident as a pretext to launch a smear campaign against Beijing. U.S. allegation of a suspected spy balloon flying in the sky of Montana has added to concerns that the already heightened tensions between Washington and Beijing would further escalate. Although balloons are a powerful potential surveillance tool, it is odd that Beijing would do something this provocative just before a key U.S. diplomatic trip, especially since China has been pushing to repair relations with the United States post-pandemic. Some in the U.S. say it is very likely that China has been using this technique for a while and that the United States was aware of it, but diplomatically chose not to respond. A U.S. Defense Department spokesman confirmed that such intrusions have happened before, saying it is not the first time that you had a balloon of this nature cross over the continental United States. It has happened a handful of other times over the past few years, to include before this administration. Some believe that the United States is spending a large budget on creating unnecessary hostility with China. Some others reason out that the tensions have flared up in recent years between the two, with Biden declaring that China is America's most consequential geopolitical challenge and competition between the two global superpowers is intense. After all, Washington and Beijing are already at loggerheads over a host of issues. That includes tensions over Taiwan. President Biden has antagonized top Chinese officials by saying on several occasions that the United States would defend Taiwan if China attacked a self-ruled island. One close ally of the administration said that although White House officials have walked back those statements, Biden is intentionally sending a message to China when he makes such pronouncements. But tensions between Washington and Beijing are not limited to that. The two powers have deep differences on other issues as well. The economic war between the United States and China, with the two countries having imposed tariffs on each other's goods, can be named as such. The U.S. presence in the South China Sea also adds to concerns that Washington and Beijing would be facing each other militarily. In the current situation, one small excuse would be enough for the whole world to wage another world war.
The United States is ramping up its efforts to counter China's growing regional power. Amid Washington's rising tensions with Beijing over the South China Sea and Taiwan, Washington and Manila agreed on plans to accelerate the full implementation of the, quote, Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, with the full agreement to designate four new agreed locations in strategic areas of the Philippines. The deal would allow Washington to deploy military equipment and rotate its troops to four more bases. Washington has currently five bases in the Philippines. The two sides also agreed on the substantial completion of the project in existing agreed locations.
Today, Secretary Galvez and I also reaffirmed our mutual defense treaty commitments. And we'd note that the mutual defense treaty applies to armed attacks on either of our armed forces, public vessels, or aircraft anywhere in the South China Sea or the West Philippine Sea.
According to experts, Washington's access to those bases could provide U.S. forces a strategic position from which to mount operations in the event of a conflict over Chinese Taipei or in the South China Sea. China has criticized the U.S. for its plan to increase its military presence in the Philippines, warning that granting the U.S. greater access to military bases by Manila could hurt regional stability and raise tensions. The move is part of U.S. plans to encircle China's maritime border in anticipation of a war over Taiwan, which Beijing considers as its own. Last year, tensions rose to unprecedented levels after the then U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island. China has repeatedly warned against any attempt that delegitimizes its national sovereignty. Furthermore, China claims sovereignty over virtually all of the South China Sea, which is also claimed in part by Brunei, Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines. The waters are believed to sit atop vast reserves of oil and gas. In another attempt to counter China, the U.S. has opened an embassy in the Solomon Islands after a 30-year absence as it seeks to boost diplomatic relations in the Pacific. The last U.S. embassy in the Solomon Islands closed in 1993. The move comes after China struck a security pact with Solomon Islands last year. It was the first known bilateral security agreement between China and a country in the Pacific. The region has become the center of a geopolitical and strategic tug-of-war between China and the U.S. Meanwhile, NATO, which is a U.S.-led military bloc, is trying to bolster its ties with Japan in a bid to strengthen an alliance against China. The NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has visited Japan, saying the Western military alliance will continue to strengthen its partnership with Tokyo.
Beijing is watching closely and learning lessons that may influence its future decisions. What is happening in Europe today could happen in East Asia tomorrow. So we must remain united and firm, standing together for freedom and democracy.
Japan is a close ally of the U.S., and in recent years, it has expanded its military ties with other Indo-Pacific nations, as well as the United Kingdom, Europe, and NATO. Back in December, Tokyo unveiled a new national security strategy that will see a large increase in its military capabilities. The strategy includes the deployment of long-range missiles. Japan also hopes to ease restrictions on arms export to strengthen its military industry.
The harsh treatment of the Israeli regime against Palestinian prisoners is continuing unabated. At least 120 Palestinian inmates in an Israeli jail are on hunger strike in protest against the regime's repressive measures. The Palestinian Prisoners' Society has said the Palestinian political prisoners started the mass strike to protest against the inhumane conditions at Israel's notorious Negev prison.
Ben-Gavir announced plans to implement several punitive measures against incarcerated Palestinians, and he's continuing with more aggressive decisions. These measures are meant to drag the Palestinian prisoners into confrontations with the soldiers.
The commission said the inmates announced their decision to launch a hunger strike in response to the new repressive measures imposed on them by Israeli prison authorities. The development came after Israeli forces stormed several sections in Megiddo, Ofer, and Negev Desert prisons, attacking Palestinian prisoners and placing a group of them in solitary confinement. The Palestinian resistance factions have warned that the tension in prisons will not stay within their walls. They say harming the prisoners will have repercussions within and outside Israeli prisons.
The vicious attack on the prisoners will lead to serious consequences. The prisoners are not alone. They always find support and serious stand from the whole Palestinians. It seems this current regime wants a war on all fronts because the situation in the occupied territories is already boiling.
Reports say the move is in response to the abuses suffered by inmates in Section 26 and 27 in the Negev, the transfer of others from Section 8 to Section 6 in the same prison, and depriving them of their possessions and basic needs. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are held under administrative detention, in which Israel keeps the detainees without charge for up to 6 months, a period which can be extended an infinite number of times. The detention takes place on orders from a military commander and on the basis of what the Israeli regime describes as secret evidence. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years. Rights groups describe Israel's use of administrative detention as a bankrupt tactic and have long called on Israel to end this move.
The decisions of the Israeli cabinet are only about using much more violence, fierce violence against Palestinian people, and about consolidating the system of racial discrimination and occupation. Their decisions will not change much and will not break the Palestinian resistance. And in my opinion, this government is failing and will continue to fail because fascism cannot prevail. And nobody can break the will of the Palestinian people to struggle to be free.
There are reportedly more than 7,000 Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Human rights organizations say Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention. Palestinian detainees have continuously resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to express outrage at the illegal detentions. Israeli jail authorities keep Palestinian prisoners under deplorable conditions without proper hygienic standards. Palestinian inmates have also been subject to systematic torture, harassment, and repression.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we briefly discussed Imam Khomeini's return from Paris to Iran a few days after the Shah's escape from the country. Today, we are going to relate the story of his arrival in Iran. After 14 years of exile, Imam Khomeini arrived in Iran on February 2, 1979. The companions of Imam were very concerned and restless as they thought of the possibility of terrorist attempts or bombing plots against the Imam during the trip. Although the last prime minister of the regime, Shapur Bakhtiar, had agreed with the landing of the Air France flight in Tehran, there were rumors among people of a conspiracy to assassinate the Imam. Some said that the airplane would explode in the air. Others spoke of the likelihood of changing the course of the airplane and abducting the Imam. However, people in the country were looking at the sky, waiting for Imam Khomeini's flight to appear. The streets leading to Mehrabad Airport were full of millions of lovers who had gathered enthusiastically to welcome their beloved leader. Hundreds of stands were set up to distribute sweets and candies among people. Yet, the only face which was unchanged and serene was the face of Imam Khomeini, as he was sitting in the airplane in complete calm. He was so calm that when a reporter asked him of his feeling in those moments, he only answered, "Nothing." This was so amazing that the reporter didn't ask any other question. Nevertheless, the Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, was very worried and preoccupied with the thought of Imam's healthy flight to Iran. She would think if the regime would let him free or would arrest and imprison him. Would the Imam's security be guaranteed during the flight? Would he be secure at the airport and his transfer from the airport to the place of his speech? Would his life be guaranteed among the swarming population in Behesht-e-Zahra Cemetery? Where would be his place of residence? These and scores of other thoughts had occupied the mind of the Imam's wife. When the news of Imam Khomeini's health reached his wife in Paris, she sighed in relief and thanked God for this great bounty. After his arrival in Iran and residing at Alavi School, Imam Khomeini asked Ayatollah Mutahhari to make the preparations for his wife's return to the country. Thus, 2 days later, the lady left Paris for Tehran. In the first days, the Imam's wife was residing at a different place due to the big number of people who came to visit the Imam. At first, women were not allowed to visit the Imam. But soon, Imam Khomeini asked those in charge to determine certain days for women's visit. Therefore, the Imam and his wife could meet one another in special intervals. In view of this, Many ladies, as soon as getting informed of Miss Saghafi's residence, eagerly rushed to visit her. Imam Khomeini's daughter, Zahra Mustafavi, says in this regard, "When my mother resided in this house, and the locals and other women were informed of her presence, rushed to meet her. My mother would sit on a bench, and the visitors would come in a long queue to greet and meet her. Some of them, who were closer relatives or old friends of the lady, would sit in the room for formal reception, and some of them would stay for lunch or dinner. My mother's warm welcome and smile was very memorable for all who met her." Dear listeners, on February 9th, just 3 days before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, a group of the Air Force officers came to Imam Khomeini's residence as a sign of their allegiance to him. Indeed, it was as a parade before the Imam. This parade was registered by Hossein Partovi, the skilled photographer, who took the photo from the back of the officers, not to be recognized by the agents of the regime. The photo of the Air Force officers was published on Kayhan newspaper. This once more revived the hope of victory in the hearts of the people, while the puppet premier of the regime, Shapur Bakhtiar, was scared and panicked. When the newspaper was taken to the imam's wife, she mentioned two important points. Firstly, the prime minister would no longer rely on the air force, and secondly, the photo was both artistic and epic. She even tried to estimate the number of the officers from the photo. The next day, a group of the Shah's special guards attacked the air force officers to avenge their parade. The news of this move soon was spread everywhere, and people confronted the guards till the next morning. When the imam's wife heard the people's support for the Air Force officers, she prayed so that all events would end in victory. Thank God, the Islamic Revolution triumphed and the enemies were frustrated.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with a number of eulogists and religious poets in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on January 12, 2023. The meeting took place one day before the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha. Some songs bring depression. They make people depressed. They discourage people. They are different. Some songs lead people towards sins. Many of the songs that are set to instrumental music are like this. Each of these songs has some music at the start of it. that inspires the singer with the song. These songs are often not appropriate. We need to be careful about the poems we recite, the songs we sing, and the elegies we read, whether they are about a tragedy or when we beat our chest, or whether it is sung in praise. We need to make sure we do not combine them with these things. This is an important point to note. I urge you to pay attention to this. Therefore, the content must be good, the structure of the poem should be good, the framework, body, appearance of the poem must be good. This will raise your audience's level of thinking.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If you put the best topics in a weak poem and read it, its effect will be greatly reduced. Allow your audience's mind to become accustomed to rich literature. This will help the intellectual growth of the society. In a similar meeting a few years ago, I referred to some of Sa'ib's ghazals, which were not ghazals on love. They were ghazals on wisdom, and they were filled with wisdom. The poetry is extremely rich and beautiful. It is good to look for those poems and read them. Thankfully, some poets write some very good poems in this field. In addition to gaining understanding in elegies, there is also stirring of emotions. This is also an important point. There is gaining understanding. This means that you are teaching people with the poem you are reciting. Many of the things we learn are from the elegies that elegists recite, things that we have already told others many times in a simple language. But when the elegist or eulogist recites the same thing with a good voice and a good melody, it is as though we are hearing, understanding, and learning something new.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The closing session of the 9th meeting of the Joint Economic Cooperation Committee of Iran and Zimbabwe was held in Tehran. During the meeting, the two sides stressed the importance of bilateral cooperation in the fields of agriculture, health, and facilitating exports of Iranian drugs into the Zimbabwean market. Iran and Zimbabwe officials agreed to use Iran's experiences in various fields, including the development of small and medium-sized enterprises, energy, and science.